Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. It's Jesse Green here at the control panels, as always. And today we are having a conversation about buying and selling businesses. Now, in particular, we're talking about the things that create value in a business. So if you're at the end of your working life and thinking about disposing of your asset that you've worked so hard to build up and develop and grow, much like a baby, you've seen it through all the stages of its life, then what we want to be thinking about is how do we prepare that business for sale so you get the maximum return, not just on your investment, but on your effort as well. And equally, if you're a buyer looking to purchase a practice, what are the things that you need to be mindful of as you walk into the practice? What potholes are there on the road ahead of you, and how can you sidestep those as well? So in our conversation today, I am joined by David C. Barnett from davidcbarnett.com. And David has a history as a finance guy, as a business broker, and today he coaches people on how to either exit their business or how to purchase a business. It's a really interesting conversation. We cover a fair bit of territory. And as always, you're going to want to have a pen and paper handy because David really shares some great wisdom, some great lessons, and some great tips that I know you're going to want to take back into your practice, no matter where you're up to in your practice life cycle. There's some sadly true information here to help you get the most out of your practice right now, today. So even if you're not ready to sell, even if you're not thinking about buying, it's still a really good exercise to listen to this because there's some wonderful business advice generally. For those people who are new to our podcast, welcome. We'd love to continue the conversation with you over at the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. It's the sister group to this particular podcast. And you can head across to drjessegreen.com/Facebook and find us there. And in that group, we've got training, tips, tools, and so on. And we'd love to see you there. It is a dentist-only Facebook group, so if you're a dentist, please do head across. We'd love to see you there. But in the meantime, I hope you really enjoy this conversation with David as much as I enjoyed recording it for you. And without any further ado, here's David Barnett. David Barnett, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us all the way from Canada. How are things with you, my friend?
Well, things are fantastic. I just got back from a two-night camping trip with my daughter's scout troop, and I'm happy to be back indoors.
Well, it is getting cold over there because it's getting warm here. And we were just having a little conversation off air about the snow quinces that you build and how that all works. And for an Australian, that's such a foreign concept and the things you do to survive the cold weather. And I was just reflecting on our conversation that it's just a different paradigm. We live in a climate that doesn't suffer that extreme. Well, not suffer, we don't enjoy that extreme cold because it is where you get the snow and all the good things that go with it. But yeah, digging holes in the ground and sleeping in there, man, I'd never thought of that. That's quite phenomenal.
Well, you know, one thing about Canada is the climate is good for people who like change. Because where I live on the East Coast in the middle of February, it can be minus 30 C. But in the summertime, we also have spells where it's in the mid 30s above zero in the summertime. So you really can enjoy some amazing beach weather. And then once you get tired of that, of course, it all changes on you rather quick.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of like life too, isn't it? Things change and life has its seasons. Business has its seasons. And I think that's something to be prepared for because no matter where we're up to in our business, things change and the business evolves. So I'd like to talk a little bit about business in the context of seasons, because you're really well known as someone who helps people in different spaces, but firstly, in understanding how to create a business that is valuable and sellable and exitable, but equally helping people identify businesses which represent a good opportunity to purchase. And so, of course, they're different ends of the life cycle of the business owner, potentially. So I wanted to ask you, I guess to start with, how you found yourself in that line of work, because it's an interesting line of work and I'm always curious to understand your journey and what took you to that point.
Yeah, sure. So I've always been interested in business, you know, childhood businesses and then going off to university to study business. And I thought that if I went and got a degree in business, I would become a businessman. And it was only after a few years I realized that they were trying to turn me into a middle manager for a big, you know, big corporation. When I got out of university, I got into sales and I started working for the Yellow Pages. And this was back in the 90s when Yellow Pages was a very relevant media to small and medium-sized business. People wanted to spend their advertising dollars locally and reach people who already wanted their service. And so the Yellow Pages was an ideal medium. But what made it so great for me is it gave me an opportunity to sit down with business managers and owners and talk with them about how their business ran and what kind of customers they were looking for. And it really gave me an introduction into the many different models of how people operate small businesses to make money for themselves and how they go about identifying opportunities for people. That eventually led me into owning my own small business with a partner. And after my partner got tired of it, we realized the best thing to do would be to sell it. And so I sold my first business naively, not really knowing what I was doing, and had the good fortune of selling it to someone who was a very stand-up, honorable person. And you know, the deal worked out fine. Knowing what I know now, there were a lot of bad things that could have happened. Eventually, I got into the business of brokering commercial debt. So I would help small businesses obtain bank loans, lines of credit, commercial mortgages, things called factoring facilities when we sell accounts receivable for money today, as well as capital leases on equipment and operating leases. And that was going really well until the financial crisis came in 2008. And at that time, a lot of the companies that I was using as a source of capital ended up going out of business. And one of the things that I noticed over and over again when I was helping people find financing for business is there were people looking to find financing to acquire businesses. And I saw so many deals that were put together really poorly by intermediaries that were looking to charge a commission and who really didn't know how to buy or sell a business. People like real estate agents, sometimes attorneys. And I saw people lose deposits. I saw people get into deals that weren't structured correctly. I remember I was once called by a Main Street banker who wanted to refer me a couple of clients. It was a newly arrived couple from Korea. They just moved to Canada. And they had used a real estate agent to help buy a convenience store. And the realtor had used the standard home purchase contract and had written it up for the business saying that they had 10 days to get 95% financing, which were the terms in those days for buying a house. And obviously, it was completely unrealistic for buying a business. It was interesting. I did business brokerage for 3 years. And in those 3 years, I intermediated the sale of 36 different businesses. And it was exciting and it was rewarding. And it was also a terrible business to be in. I was married at the time. I had two young children. And because it was a model based on what we typically see in real estate, where people list their business to sell, as it were. And then when I sell it, I collect a commission. Here's the problem, though. It can take up to 3 years to sell a business. And so there was no ability to plan, no ability to create a budget. And so I would sometimes go 3, 4, 5, 9 months without a deal closing. Meanwhile, I was paying my assistant, I was paying for rent, paying for advertising. And so what I thought was going to be a very lucrative business that would bring me lots of money, in fact, brought me lots of debt. And then occasionally I would stick my head above the water. And after the end of 2011, you know, I had a fantastic summer. I actually had 6 deals lined up to close in the fall, and they were going to bring me $250,000 of commissions. And then one deal fell apart because a bank rescinded a financing letter that they had issued. They approved the loan, then they unapproved the loan. So that deal fell apart. The second deal fell apart because it was in a regulated industry and the government agency responsible for licensing wouldn't issue a license to the buyer. So deal number two fell apart. And deal number three was a franchise business, and the buyer met with the franchisor, and the franchisor's they just weren't very nice to him, and he did not like them. And I remember he actually said in person to the seller, he said, "I love your business and I would love to own it, but I do not want to get into business with those guys." And so deal number three fell apart. And that quarter of $1 million of revenue turned into $110,000. And I looked at the numbers and I said, you know what? This money will get me out of this. And I need to get out. And so I left business brokerage and I went into banking and I started a career with an international bank. And I started to visit people to talk about revolving credit lines and things like this. And it's funny because we have a lot of big spaces in Canada and I was covering three different provinces. So I would spend a lot of time in my car driving from one city to the next. And my phone started to ring. And it was people who had heard my name or they'd been referred to me because they were trying to buy or sell a business. And at first I would tell people, no, I don't do that anymore. But then one day a guy called me and he explained his problem and I knew that he was getting into something he probably shouldn't have. And I said, look, I can help you, but I have a full-time job. And so I'll have to help you on evenings and weekends and I'm not a broker anymore. So I'll have to charge you like a consultant. And without missing a beat, he just said, okay, well, can you meet me Saturday at 9? And I said, sure. And that was the beginning of a little side practice in consulting that after about 2 years grew to the point where it replaced my income from the bank. And then in conjunction with that, I started the YouTube channel and I started to write books. And I just realized that there's a market for people who want the advice of somebody who's been through these deals before to help guide them through the process, much in the same way people will use an accountant or a lawyer. You have a problem, you got a tax problem, you go to the accountant, they help you with it, you pay them, just like that. And it always frustrated me when I was a broker that I would talk to people and educate people all the time. And then later I would find out that they did a deal on their own. And I didn't earn anything from that.
I know a broker who feels that way too.
Well, nowadays I realize that that advice, that education, that knowledge is valuable and people want to buy that, especially if they feel they can do the deal, they just need some help.
So that's really interesting. There's a lot of things in there that I'd love to come back and we'll certainly circle around to all of the things. But I wanted to discuss business models up front because I think business models are an important conversation because no matter how hard you work, if your business model is not correct, you've got the ladder up the wrong tree. You can climb that ladder enthusiastically. You're just climbing the wrong tree. So for people listening to this podcast, that they're typically dentists, they're in practice. Most of them are in a self-employment situation if they own the practice. Very few have made the leap into what I call true business ownership, where they're reliant on systems and team rather than a key person situation. How would you suggest to people, for anyone thinking about exitability, now bearing in mind that people may not want to exit immediately, they might not want to exit for a decade, but it's about building an asset that, as you say, has intrinsic worth. So when compared to other items of inventory of similar ilk, it looks and seems to be more appealing than its competitors. How would you suggest dentists go about building a business that is exitable in the first place?
Well, I think, what's that expression? It's hard to see the frame when you're standing in the picture.
Yeah, so true.
So, Let me give you an example, but instead of dentists, let's talk about roofers, because I think it can be helpful to look at the perspective in another trade, another profession. So I have in the past dealt with many different roofers who wanted to either buy or sell a business. And most people get into roofing because they know how to install shingles. And so for whatever reason, they end up going off and finding a contract to do someone's home, let's say, on their own. And maybe they do that by themselves. And then after a while, they're willing to invest in some help. And they start to get some other laborers involved. And because they know how to do the work and they're there all the time, they can run the business. And whether they realize it or not, they do have systems. They're just not documented. So they know how to replace the shingles on a roof. Now, if you're successful in this way as a roofer and you have a crew of people working for you and you suddenly decide you want to sell your business, the only person you can sell the business to is another person with an equivalent degree of experience and knowledge, because they have to be able to take over your spot up on the roof, right? But if we compare that to another kind of roofing firm, and if you think about maybe some of the marketing or advertising you've received in your home for a company that is going to come in and they're going to bring a crew of guys and they're going to park a dumpster in your driveway and they're going to do the job in a day, and they're able to coordinate the delivery of the shingles and the removal of the shingles, and there's a different crew for this and different guys for that, what you're dealing with is a real business. And so I've had buyers before who have looked at roofing businesses and they'll say things like, I don't know anything about installing roofs. And the seller is able to say, well, you don't need to, because my employees know how to do it. And then the buyer will say, well, I don't know how to price a roof. And the seller will say, well, actually, I've developed this spreadsheet program. And by taking measurements and putting in the product cost, it helps us protect our margin and make sure that we don't underbid a job. So what's starting to happen, you see, is that by actually having documented systems in place, a real business structure in place, suddenly now the business can be sold to more than simply another roofer. It can be sold to a wide variety of people because they can now see that they'll be able to take over and run those systems, right? So by building something that is more organized, where different players know their role, things are written down, responsibilities are outlined, expectations are detailed, what ends up happening is that now you can reach a wider pool of buyers. And in the world of business brokerage, and then when you get into bigger business, we call it mergers and acquisitions, there is a sweet spot where if the earnings are at a certain level, the buying field even opens up to people who have no intention of running the businesses at all, what we call strategic buyers in the private equity groups or the private investment groups. And they're simply looking for businesses that they can run with a professional manager. So basically, at the low end of the value scale, if you have a business that can only be run by someone like you, the value of the business is going to be limited by the availability of buyers who are just like you. Whereas if the systems are there, then we open ourselves up to what's called a strategic buyer. And a strategic buyer is able to do more with the businesses that they purchase and therefore are willing to pay more. So to get back to the roofing example, if you have two cities that are an hour apart and a successful roofing company in both cities, and one person wants to grow his business, and in another city, the person wants to leave the industry, if that second person who wants to exit has created systems and processes, it means that the buyer who's an hour away can acquire that business and he can run it with a manager on site. He doesn't actually have to be there. And what he'll likely want to do is he'll want to consolidate some of the overhead activities, and he'll actually reduce some of the expenses and overheads of the company he's acquiring, which means in conducting the acquisition, the new owner will actually make the acquired business more profitable than the previous owner was able to.
Yeah, I really love that. So just to come back, there's a couple of lessons here. So ladies and gents, if you've just tuned into our podcast, we're having a conversation with David Barnett, and you can find him at www.davidcbarnett.com. And we're talking all about exitability of a practice or of a business. And we've used a roofing example because, as David quite rightly points out, when you're standing in the picture, you can't see the frame. And using another industry is a really good way to see the key points. So just to pick up on a couple of those key points, David, one is to make sure that we need to understand we do have systems. We've just got to make sure that they come out of our head and they're captured in a documentation process. We need to make sure that our team knows their role, what their expectations are, and they're clear about those expectations. And we need to make sure that as we go about this, we need to an extent, remove ourselves from being the source of all knowledge, and so that if we do want to exit a business, we're not limited to finding someone with similar expertise as ourselves. We open ourselves up to a broader array of buyers, and if the earnings are sufficient, then as you say, you can get that strategic purchaser, strategic buyer who might be looking to just install professional management. Have I captured that in a nutshell?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Perfect. So the couple of things I really like about this, mate, because I think most people in small business, you know, whether they've read the E-Myth or come across similar sorts of literature, that most people understand, I've got to create systems, I've got to create processes, I've got to get myself out of being the source of the knowledge. You know, the bottleneck's always at the top of the bottle, as they say. But on a practical level, some people still find that a bit of a struggle to do. Intellectually, we get it. But why is it that some people find that a hard process to get done, whereas others can do it a little more easily? Because it's one thing to know how to do it, it's another thing to actually do it. Where does the disconnect happen?
Oh, that's a really great question. Back when I was a business broker, I used to think that people existed along a spectrum of intelligence. You know, it's pretty simple outlook, but I always would wonder, how can a person build a multi-million dollar business and not see the value in investing a little bit of time in, you know, documenting and creating systems to make their business run better? And it was only later, when I discovered the Myers-Briggs personality types, that it really started to make sense to me, because I happen to be one of the personality types who's very oriented towards sitting down and thinking about things and planning things out, working backwards from the goal to build a plan. And most entrepreneurs are not like that. Most entrepreneurs are driven, you know, to succeed, and they see an opportunity and they jump maybe a little bit before they think, but they're able to come out on top. And a lot of the things that make entrepreneurs so successful maybe are not quite aligned with the whole idea of sitting down and planning and doing that kind of work. So when I was a business broker, I used to buy copies of the E-Myth and give it to people. And I would say, if you work on your business for a year and get some of this stuff in place, it'll be easier for me to sell your business, right? And nobody would ever read it. And so
for Michael Gerber, who's listening, we're really sorry about that, okay?
And then I thought, you know what? Why do people give money to their financial planner, right? If you give money to your financial planner today, it means you can't spend it on any goodies, right? But the reason people do it is because they're willing to live with a little bit of pain today to get more in the future, because that money will grow under financial management, right? And this systems thing, this working on your business, is exactly the same. What we're talking about is investing some time today so that you save time in the future. And it becomes a righteous cycle. Like it starts to reinforce itself. The more you spend time working on your business, creating these systems and processes, the more liberty you obtain in the future. The problem most people have is when they sit down at the end of the day and they're exhausted from all the work that they've done, they say, now what do I do? What do I do right now, right? Eventually, it led me to creating a process that I use with my clients, where I actually took the Michael Gerber E-Myth process and I said, hey, what if I had a process for systematizing businesses? And that's what I did, is it actually created a step-by-step process that I work through with my clients. Because at the end of the day, the entrepreneur, the roofer, is an expert in installing shingles, not an expert in organizing businesses.
So that's a really good point. So, because there'll be some people listening to this podcast right now going, that's me, you know, I get to the end of the day, I know I should be doing this and I know I should be doing that. But quite frankly, when 6 o'clock in the evening comes around, all I really want to do is collapse. And then even if they've got the energy, they don't quite know where to start. So I wanted to ask you, with this process, I love the system for developing systems, by the way, that's so meta. but it's so important as well. What would be, so for someone listening now, what would be the first thing that they should do to get that ball rolling?
Well, you see, it's all about knowing where you're headed. So when I work with people, the very first thing we do has nothing to do with the business at all. What I say is, describe your life in 10 years. What kind of income do you have? How many weeks of vacation? Do you have a holiday home on the ocean? Do you have a sailing boat? Do you have a big recreational vehicle? Tell me what your life looks like. Because we need to know where we're headed, because then the second question is, now we have to describe the business that's capable of delivering that lifestyle, right? And so if we realize, hey, in order for me to enjoy this life in 10 years' time, I need to build a business that, you know, is doing 2.5 times the sales of my present business. Now that we know where we're headed, we can start to build the map to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So ladies and gents, as you listen there, it's really important to have a good, clear picture of what your life is going to be like in the next 10 years and then reverse engineer out of that. Now, of course, we've just mentioned earlier that for some people that may not be a natural inclination. That said, I think we've just got to, you know, knuckle down and get it done as well. So, David, for those people whose Myers-Briggs personality profiles don't fit the reverse engineering sorts, do you have any little tools or tips for those guys that might find that a little bit uncomfortable or just a little bit out of their flow?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's ultimately what I did, is I ended up creating an online course called Build a Business That People Will Want to Buy, just so that people can go through and work through the 12 steps on their own. And then I only work with people who reach out and say, I still need more help. But it's a matter of just showing someone, just like somebody taught that roofer at some point in his past how to install that shingle. Once you know what to do, put one foot in front of the other, it's very simple. And for a dentist, for example, you know, every procedure that's performed in the office, there is a process, right? So anyone who can succeed in becoming a dentist can certainly succeed in learning how to plan and organize their business. Because when you sit in the chair and when you have your patient in front of you and your support staff around you, you are running those systems. It's just that they're in your head, right?
Fantastic. All right, mate. So let's just change gear for a second, because I think we've kind of covered off on the fact that if we're going to create a business that has an intrinsic value, something that is going to not just produce higher earnings along the way, but is exitable, then we need to, as we spoke about earlier, we need to make sure that we remove ourselves from the bottleneck and so on. And you've given us a really good, some thought starters around that. I wanted to ask you around, going back to your broking days and certainly in the education space you're in now, what do you see as common mistakes of people wanting to sell a business? Because sometimes people get to that point in their life, they go, right now is the time to exit. I'm ready to hand this over to someone else. What are the common mistakes that occur in that journey?
There are a couple that keep recurring over and over again. And so one of them, of course, is not being prepared. Most entrepreneurs have a succession plan that simply says, I'll just live forever. They don't actually ever make a plan. And what that means is that the little things that entrepreneurs sometimes do, like giving a spouse a gas card for the vehicle that gets paid by the company, or giving teenage children company cell phones, things like this, they're all really great little perks that help soften the tax blow maybe someday. But what ends up happening is that while you can demonstrate to a buyer the true benefit of owning your business, sometimes the buyer cannot in turn demonstrate that same value to his banker. And so people can sometimes run businesses in a way that are very tax advantage for them in the present, but what they end up doing is making their business unbankable, which means that buyers have a greater difficulty in obtaining financing. So financing is one big piece of the puzzle. And for most small businesses, the financing is a mix between the buyer's money. Maybe there's money that's available from a lender, usually for more tangible assets, equipment, inventory, that kind of thing. And then oftentimes the seller of the business has to provide some financing in the form of a seller note. In dentistry, though, it can be a little bit different because many of the banks are willing to finance a greater degree. They're even financing the goodwill component of a dental practice.
Certainly here and, they do.
Yeah. And that sounds like a great thing. If you want to buy a dental practice, hey, I can get financing from a bank. I don't have to worry about the money. But, and it's great for sellers who have gotten their business prepared so that it looks as good as it can. But what that can ultimately do, though, which is not in the best interest of buyers, is it can create some price inflation where if you compare houses, let's say, what would happen to houses if you couldn't get a mortgage?
The prices would be through the floor.
Well, all you have to do is look at a part of town that was built up 100 years ago. And what you find is these big homes where, you know, when the adult son got married, instead of going off and getting a mortgage for a new house, what he did is all the cousins came over and they built a new bedroom on the back of the parents' house. Everything was more bootstrapped. And so when financing is available for homes, all of a sudden we have all these homes being built because people can buy them. And when it comes to business, if you can get more financing, then there's an upward pressure on pricing. The other thing that works against the buyers in that scenario is that because there's no vendor financing, then it becomes more difficult to offset against any kind of misrepresentation that may have been made by the seller. So it makes the transaction more risky for the buyer. But here's the thing that sellers often don't consider. Most sellers think, when I sell my business, I want to be paid and get a big check, and I'm going to walk away with all that money. And if you do that, you're actually missing out on some of the gravy. Because vendors who finance part of the transaction are taking away the financing problem for the buyer. That in itself can also have an upward pressure on prices, but then they also collect interest on those notes. I actually had an interview on my YouTube channel just recently, a fellow on Prince Edward Island who sold his auto repair business, and he actually chose to finance the transaction 100% once he realized that he'd be able to get a better price for his business and collect all the profits that the banker would have had.
Yeah, wow, that's fantastic, isn't it? So with that, okay, so just coming back to that, we need to understand a couple of the common mistakes, having a clean set of books you mentioned earlier. And interestingly enough, I was looking at a dental practice to buy. Oh, this is going back probably a year ago now, and the vendor at the time was saying, look, in essence, this is my language, but you've just got to trust me. There's probably, you know, $90,000 of ad backs there because I'm running a car, I'm running my professional development, I'm running this, I'm running that. It's all just buried in the print, but just trust me on this, right? And I'm going, well, you know, you're very nice and all, but trust and verification kind of go hand in hand here with this kind of money. So the clean books and running the things through the business, yes, there's some tax advantages. Is that probably the most common issue you see? I'm just trying to get a sense of the scale of that problem.
Almost every business owner is doing something to create some sort of advantage for themselves. The second big issue, though, and this is one that I see to an even greater degree, is not pricing it right. But sellers will think, hey, if I put the business up, you know, a little bit high in price, I can always bring it down later. Actually not quite true, because here's what happens. The buyers who are out there are educated now because of the internet. They've been doing research. They've been on my YouTube channel. They've read some of my books, what have you. They've read other people's books. They know what a certain kind of dental practice is likely going to sell for within a certain ballpark. And if you're asking 30 or 40% more or 50% or 100% more, the reasonable buyer, this is the person with money, good credit, who's already had a conversation with his banker. Maybe he's already built up a certain clientele as an employee he thinks he can bring over, right? That buyer is going to look at you and go, wow, that guy's crazy. I can't talk to that person. And who you will end up talking to are the tire kickers or the people who don't know what they're doing, who will then start to waste all your time. And we try to keep business sales confidential because we're trying to protect the value of the brand. If employees find out a business is for sale, they might be worried about their future. If customers find out a business is for sale, they might be worried that the next dentist isn't going to be as pleasant or what have you. And so we want to keep it secret. Eventually, though, word will likely get out. And so if we've overpriced the business and a bunch of people come and kick the tires and they waste a year of our time, and then people hear that the business has been for sale for a year, reasonable buyers will then start to say, well, what's wrong with it? If nobody's bought it yet, what's wrong with it that I haven't seen? So I always say to people, when it comes time to sell, you make your decision, I'm going to sell the business, get some proper advice to price it correctly so that as soon as it hits the market, you'll be able to attract the attention of all the reasonable buyers that you can. And maybe you can even get a couple of people chasing you. You might get a certain auction situation going on where you have more than one buyer, which is great. Well, because we're talking about a business, what people are buying is a cash flow. And if you look at things like government bonds, for example, the price of the bond is dictated by the interest rate. Well, in a business, the price of the cash flow for a business is dictated by the perceived risk in the cash flow. And small businesses are riskier than bonds. And so there's a certain area of pricing that people are going to be willing to pay based on their perception of risk. They're not going to go beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we speak about in the work that we do is putting some thought to the question, if you are an existing business owner, what are the things that could disrupt my flow of income, my cash flow? What are the things that could derail that? And then trying to identify the risks in the business, mitigate those risks, and make sure that when you do put that business for sale, those risks have been handled. And of course, it's a prettier asset that goes to market than it would otherwise be with a couple of ugly bits to it.
I once had a buyer and seller sitting across from each other, and it was a restaurant business. And the buyer asked, how can I be sure that the employees are going to stick around after I buy the business? Because I don't know how to run this restaurant as well as you do, and I need those employees. And the seller leaned forward and he said, you know what? I'll guarantee you that within the year, they'll all be gone. And he said, this is the business we're in. And that's why I have developed this system for attracting the best employees. And he started to detail how he advertises, the little test he applies to sort out the good applicants from the poor ones, and how he's able to train people in only 2 days to get them productive in his business. And so that is how systems overcome fears that the buyers have.
I think that's really important because you want to, if you're selling your business, you want this to be essentially the least risky thing the owner or the new owner could take on. You want to just have them be able to hop into the pilot seat and continue to fly the plane. And if you can mitigate that risk up front, then you're going to get a much better sale price.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what about when it comes to buying a business? So again, let's go to the other side of the transaction, buying businesses. Where do people come unstuck there?
People get stuck on analysis paralysis. They get stuck with those fears. And one of the things that I teach through my different programs is that, and again, this is where the financing thing comes into play. When you buy a small business, you will never be able to know the business as well as the seller. And the situation you described where someone said, look, there's another $90,000 of cash flow here that's kind of been hidden, that happens all the time. And the way to deal with it is actually not to unscramble the omelet. The way to deal with it is through the structure of the deal. And that's why the seller financing becomes so important, because you basically what you say is, I'll believe everything that you said to me. But if it later turns out not to be true once I'm in charge, I have the right to offset against what I owe you. And so now the seller knows that he'll be held accountable for every one of those things that he shows you or claims, and that you have the power to control the flow of cash. I always use the example of this, of a forklift. If you bought a factory and there was a forklift on site and you paid for it in full, and then 3 months later, the repo man showed up because the leasing company hasn't been paid for their forklift, you say, well, wait a minute. I bought the business. The forklift is on the list of assets. I own it now. And they show you paperwork saying otherwise. You can sue him, but you're going to have to engage a lawyer, pay his retainer, get a court date. And then once you get the judgment, you have to find the person and hope that they still have the money, right? And that you can find it. Whereas if there's a seller financing note, you simply write a letter to the guy saying, you sold me something you didn't own. I'm offsetting the money I had to pay the leasing company against what I owe you. And then if they're upset with that, they have to take you to court and prove that they actually did own the forklift.
So I think that's really clever, isn't it? The deal structure is so important, isn't it? It's, you know, what I'm hearing loud and clearly is it's not just a case of here's what you're buying, here's the price, sign and get on with it. It really does come back to having a good amount of experience and working with someone who knows how to put a deal together and to identify those potential hassles and write that into the deal.
Businesses are constantly changing things. And one of the best descriptions I've ever heard is that a business is actually just a system for serving people and collecting money, right? And we hope that it turns out to be a profitable system. It makes it very different from a used car. The used car is a tangible item. I take it to my mechanic. He looks it over and he says, you know what? Within reason, I think it's in good shape. I have a pretty good idea what I'm buying. So I can agree on a price and pay the seller. With a business, you can't even examine everything because by its very nature, a system are people interacting with each other. It's something that happens. It's not a thing you can look at.
Yeah. No, again, I think that's just so important. So for anyone listening, guys, I'd really encourage you as you're going through the process of either buying or selling a business, it's really important to think about some of these potential headaches that are going to occur as we do things. Things like unpicking or finding out where that money might be. But again, as David said, not unscrambling the egg necessarily, writing that into the contract and having a way of holding that money back. And David, they've been some absolute pearls of wisdom in everything that we've gone through today. You're an absolute scholar and a gentleman, and you've written, I'm trying to count how many books there are on your website, mate, but there is a ton of them. And I'd really recommend anyone who's listening to our podcast to check out David's website. It's davidcbarnett.com, and it's just a treasure trove of goodies. So anything you want to think about creating value in your business, exiting your business, buying a business, there's a course there about systemizing your business and getting that done. I'd really encourage you to check it out because I think it's valuable. I think it's really useful. And I know it's going to put your business in better shape. Mate, you've been an absolute gem. Just as we wrap up our conversation today, I just wanted to, because this is a topic, mate, I think we need to get you back for another episode because this is a topic that we could go for hours and hours and hours on. But I wanted to ask you really quickly, if you were to have the gospel according to David on a billboard, you know, driving through your locality there, what would be a couple of key things you'd want to leave the audience with?
My whole mission, the reason I do what I do, is to prevent people from getting into bad deals. One of the saddest things that happens for me too regularly is I get emails from people who say, I've stumbled across your YouTube channel and I wish I had seen it 3 years ago. And here's what happened to me. And if you're going to invest, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or $1 million in something, just look at it from an insurance point of view. Hire all the advisors you need to make sure that things are as they're represented. And that goes for sellers as well, because there are all kinds of ways that you can end up selling yourself short. I'm working on a deal right now where a couple are selling their restaurant to my client, who's the buyer. I'm helping him, but they're basically selling this restaurant for just a tad more than the value of the land and building. They don't understand what it is that they have. They haven't gotten the proper advice.
That's sad and for them.
It's really sad. This is their life's work. So get advice and get someone to help you.
Okay, fantastic. So ladies and gents, please, if you're in that space of buying or selling, do reach out, find someone who can help you, someone who can educate you to make smart decisions. someone who can highlight the potential pitfalls and equally put together a strategy and a bit of a map about how you might get around some of those things and how to structure that deal. David, you have been incredibly generous today, mate, and I thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to round two on the show because I know that there's a lot of threads that we're going to pull on and really dig down into that a bit more. I think it's a topic that we could really explore a lot more. So, but in the meantime, thank you so much today, mate. You're very kind, very generous.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.